Welcome to Nexus 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African-American community. I'm your host, Doc JC. This episode of Nexus 818 Podcast features the Montfort Port Marines. After 144 years of exclusion due to segregation, approximately 20,000 African-American men were admitted into the U.S. Marine Corps. For their valiant service to our nation, these Marines were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in November of 2011. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out episode 27 from October the 4th of 2023 to learn about the background of the Montfort Port Marines. I am pleased to welcome to episode 30, the descendants of Staff Sergeant Charles Edward Allen, who served in the Montfort Port Marines. My guests tonight are Mike and Marlon Allen, sons of Montfort Port Staff Sergeant Charles Allen. Welcome, Mike and Marlon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I always like to start out with a few interesting facts. So first, Charles was at the forefront of the Civil Rights Movement. He was one of the first 100 African Americans to enlist in the U.S. Marine Corps. Second, he was one of the first Black drill instructors in the Marines. And third, all four of his sons served in the Marine Corps. That's pretty impressive, guys.
Wow. Yeah, check.
Yeah, right, Semper Fi, I know.
Do that.
So let's talk a little bit about your dad. He was born in Gloucester, Mississippi in 1923.
Yes.
So about how old was he when he enlisted?
He went in 1942, so he was 19. I think he maybe had just made 20. He was 19, though. He came out of
Tuscaloosa. He was 19 when he enlisted. I think when he went active, he had turned 20.
Yeah. Okay. So what was he doing at the time of enlistment? I understand he had attended Tuskegee. He was in school and at the time he enlisted?
He was a student at Tuskegee when he enlisted. His mother had worked really hard to try to get him into Tuskegee. That's where he said he wanted to go. And him being an only child, he would never say he was spoiled, but his mother made sure anything he wanted, he got.
All right.
She worked really hard, you know, cleaning houses for other folks in order for him to go to Tuskegee. And he went there, and it wasn't too long after he got to Tuskegee, Roosevelt signed that executive order, and he decided to leave and enlist in the Marine Corps.
So what made him make that decision? Do you have any sense of that? Why did he decide to enlist rather than fulfill his mother's desires and dreams for him to finish Tuskegee?
Almost all of these guys, and I've had the opportunity to talk to, you know, several of the Montfort Pointers, and almost all of them say almost the same thing, and that is that they felt it was their duty. You know, World War II was on, and they also felt that if they had to go, they wanted to be, if the Marine Corps was the best and the toughest, that's where they wanted to be.
Okay. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
And that's pretty much what my dad had said. If they're supposed to be the best, and that's where I want to be. He also said that he had to have a set of those dress blues.
Well, they're very stunning outfits. So so how did his mom react when he enlisted?
She was not happy. She was not very happy that he was dropping out of school to go in the Marines. She knew that the war was going on. She felt that that was a lot of danger, putting his life at risk. And plus the fact that her goal, her objective was for him to get a diploma from Tuskegee. And he's dropping out to go in the Marines. She was not very happy.
Okay. So it was a very difficult time for African Americans in the 40s. It is said that Black soldiers had to fight a two-front battle, victory from enemies without and victory over enemies at home. So what do you, it was an act of valor, really, to enlist at that time. What do you think made your dad special? I know he liked the blues, but the blue uniforms, but...
You know, I think all of those guys, World War II is going on, the country's in at peril, and I think all of those guys just felt that it was their duty. They felt that they needed to do it, you know, and all the ones that I've spoken to, they said, hey, we did what we had to do. We knew we had to go. And they said, hey, we did it.
It's always so fascinating because I've heard the same thing from the women who went in the 6888, who enlisted and then was selected for the 6888. They talked about duty. And you think, if you think of all the things that were going on in America in the 40s, you would think that one might not be as patriotic as a lot of our ancestors were. So given how Black Americans were treated in this country.
Yeah, that'd be a good reason to feel that way. And when I've had the opportunity to talk, to speak at Congressional Gold Medal presentations and funerals, I've always mentioned that, you know, it takes a lot for these guys to do what they did, especially going and fighting to defend a country that was not treating them very well.
Right.
You know, I mean, they were considered second-class citizens and treated even less than that, and they still said, hey, we got to do this.
That was, a lot of them felt that was not only their obligation, but their an opportunity to prove that they are just as good as the other
right.
guy.
Right. So what type of work did your dad do in the Marines?
He actually spent his entire enlistment as a drill instructor. He was one of the first 6 Black drill instructors, and he stayed on the drill field, to my knowledge, the whole time.
Okay, so he didn't go to the Pacific?
No.
Okay.
No, he did tell me one time that there was a white captain who had asked him several times to please. I guess the captain may have been involved with boot camp and recruits coming in. And this white captain asked him to stay with him, please stay with me. And I guess by choice, he decided to stay on the drill field.
Okay. So I'm interested in these stories that your dad may have shared with you about his time in the service. Any adventures or painful or scary or funny memories?
Yeah, there's a few. He didn't talk a lot. He didn't talk a lot about his time. Put it like this. He wasn't the type of person to talk about the past a whole lot. And a lot of the things that they went through, you would only catch bits and pieces here and there. He never would just sit and talk about it. You know, he told stories to me about times when Blacks were arrested in South Carolina for wearing a Marine Corps uniform because the authorities, the police, who were all white, said that there were no Black Marines. So they didn't use the word Black, but right. you can imagine they told them that they were impersonating when they said what we've been arrested for. They said impersonating a Marine, and they would have to call the base and talk to the commanding officer or someone with authority to say that, yes, they're all Black Marines. You have to let them go. So he said sometimes they would spend their liberty locked up and getting out.
You know, the Montfort pointers that I talked to mentioned to me in one particular instance that they said when they made the first Black drill instructors, the recruits thought, oh boy, this is going to be much better. It's going to be much easier. And one of the Montfort pointers said in a group of about 3 or 4 plus myself, he said, man, but when them Negroes came in, he said, it was even harder. They made it even harder on us. And they kind of laughed, but then one of them in the group said, I know why. He said, I know why they did it. He said, because they wanted us to be better than the white recruits. And, you know, just 3 hours away, actually 3 hours and 36 minutes away, was a place called Paris Island, which is where the white troops, recruits were being trained. And you can bet your bottom dollar that what the white recruits are going through was probably the most challenging thing that they had done in their lives as a young man, but it wasn't near what was happening at Marfa Point.
Right.
They were abusing them on a regular, every day. So
you mean physical abuse or emotional abuse or all of the above?
All of the above. There were stories of them having them stand outside with nothing but, as the Marine Corps, as the Navy and the Marine Corps say, skivvies. You know what skivvies are?
Yes, I know. Right.
So they would have them stand outside in their skivvies in the evening at attention, and the mosquitoes were eating them up. And if anybody moved or anybody flinched, then they made it a little bit longer. But the physical abuse and the mental abuse, the verbal abuse, it was constant. Every day, not some days, not most days, every day. So, but they went through it. And you know, what I always ask the groups when I get a chance to speak to them, and I ask the question, how many of you would have done it? How many of you could have done it? And usually they all say they couldn't. When I went through boot camp, it was difficult. Probably the most difficult thing I had done, you know, in my 19 years of life. But it was nothing compared to what they went through. Believe me.
I'd like to hear more about what your dad did when he completed his military service, education, career, in the community, activism.
Yeah, he took a job at the post office. And at the time that he took the job, from what I understand from him, there was not many Blacks involved with the union for the post office. And he became a union steward. He spent his whole postal career delivering mail, a letter carrier. And he said that he enjoyed that because it was time for him to be like away from everyone. It was just him and his world on his route delivering his mail, you know? Like I said, he never really talked about a whole lot of the bad times in the military, but we do know there was a lot of them because every now and then he would spit out something. But he said that being on the route for the post office, he was in his world. I eventually started working at the post office. And he used to tell me how, oh, it's different now, boy. It's different. You don't know the hard time. So, yeah.
You know, Doc, he was always such a outspoken and aggressive person.
Yes.
When he was at the post office, a lot of the Black carriers were astounded because they would often say to him, Charles, how do you get away with talking to the supervisor like that? And the supervisors were always white. And he would always say, he put his pants on just like me. He's a man just like me, he said. And I'm mad at him. I'm telling him I'm mad at him. And when he voiced his opinion, it wasn't always in schoolroom words. It was usually something. And they all were astounded. All his coworkers were like, how does he get away with this? But they never messed with him. I got to say, most of the people, they were afraid of him because he stood up, he was firm, but he was always right. He wasn't just being ugly. He was right. And he would tell them, I don't have to put up what you're doing or what you're saying. And he let them know. Very outspoken.
I bet you all inherited some of that too.
Probably a little bit, but you know what though, Doc? Show you how life goes. He made some changes later on in life because his family, we were all amazed at the fact that, oh Lord, I want to say it was late 1980s or so, he became a Eucharistic minister.
Yeah.
in a Catholic church. And we were like, what? a sharp, sharp contrast to somebody who could use four-letter words pretty easily, who was harsh. He could be harsh, but he became a Eucharistic minister.
Yeah, and of course, became friendly with the priest who was over the parish, and sometimes the priest would come by the house, and when he was talking with the priest, you would think that he was just talking to, you know, any Joe from off the street, because like we said, Charles Allen didn't cut any corners or curve his tongue or anything when he was talking.
So was he able to take advantage of the GI Bill when it came out of service?
Yes. Yeah.
And what did he do with that? How did he use it?
Bought a house in Pontchartrain Park. Pontchartrain Park is a subdivision here in New Orleans that was built exclusively for Black occupancy. And also a lot of the people who were able to get into Pontchartrain Park in the early days of it were government employees or mostly prior military. So yeah, he used his GI Bill for that. And that was a very good move. It gave you a little bit more status,
right,
in the city, because you were, you know, living in Pontchartrain Park where Blacks were owning their own homes.
It was an assumed status, Doc, because a lot of the other people thought, oh, they live in Pontchartrain Park, they're rich.
Yeah.
We didn't have.
No, we were cutting pork chops for the kids.
Look, when they cooked the chicken in our house, every single piece was eaten, including the neck. And, you know, nothing was wasted. So even that part that they say is the last part that goes over the fence.
Right.
So yeah, but people thought they lived in Pontchartrain Park, they're doing well, they're rich, and it wasn't even near that. I'll tell you a funny story about when we moved in. When we moved into Pontchartrain Park, they had several different floor plans, and each floor plan was designed for families of certain, in other words, if you had one child, then you could get the two-bedroom floor plan. Mother and dad in one room, kid in the other room. If you had two children, then you could get the three-bedroom floor plan. And when we moved into Pontchartrain Park, we were one of the first, like number five or something like that, to move into Pontchartrain Park. And some of the other families that came along after, I recall one of the gentlemen in the neighborhood asked my dad, he said, Charles, I don't understand how you got that floor plan. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, that floor plan you got was for husband, wife, with two kids. And he said, okay. And he said, well, you don't have two kids. He said, when they asked me, did I have two kids? I said, yes. He said, but you got six. He said, they didn't ask me if I had six. They asked me if I had two. And I said, yes. I'll tell you one thing, Doc, that's interesting, and Maul and I have talked about this before. When I went in the Marine Corps and when he went in the Marine Corps, as I mentioned, the Marine Corps boot camp is very challenging, particularly if you're a young man. And I was saying that Marine Corps boot camp is particularly challenging for anybody. But I was talking to Maul and then about it recently, not very long ago. And when I went in, it was challenging. But guess what? It seemed to be worse for everybody else. But we realized why. Because the way my dad raised us, coming out of being a drill instructor, some of the tactics that he used in boot camp, he used with us. So when we went to boot camp, none of this was new. Everybody else was moaning and groaning. We were wondering, what's the big deal? You know, but we were used to those tactics. I can recall one time, my dad had my younger brother and I, not Lot Marlin, but the other brother who's deceased. He had us, we did something, I don't even remember what we did, something that made him angry. And he told us to take two shovels. He took us to the edge of our property line. He said, I want you to dig a hole right here. And it's got to be this big, this deep.
So we're wondering, okay. So we dug the hole. He'd come back and check, and he'd say, no, it's not deep enough. And we dig a little further, a little wider. And finally, when it was about what he thought he wanted, he'd look at it and say, okay, you finished? So yeah. He said, now fill it back up. And we were thinking, what's going on with this? But that was his way of punishing us, you know? And you go in Marine Corps boot camp, a lot of times the methods that they use don't make much sense, but they are punishment. But he used to do those kinds of things. So when we went in boot camp, it was not nearly as challenging as the other recruits' experience because we were used to those tactics. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you if any lessons he learned, he passed on to you guys. I see that was one of the lessons he learned.
That was one, yeah, that was one. Now, I'm going to tell you something else. Doc, he thought so much of the Marines that he would tell anybody who was in any other branch that they didn't meet the standards. Marines, you know, we did more, the Marines did more with less than all of the rest. And we had even a neighbor, who was in the Army during Korea, and our next door neighbor, and he claimed and kind of checked for, I guess what they call nowadays PTSD, or rather PT, you know, post-traumatic stress. So anyway, he got a check for supposedly being crazy, and this guy used to cut his grass by the street light at night.
The same electricity?
No, because the street light, he could go out and cut his grass and didn't have to be out there in the daytime when it was hot.
Okay.
So everybody in the neighborhood complained about that and said, you know, Billy's over there cutting his grass and we're trying to watch TV or we, you know, sitting down to eat or getting ready for bed. So my daddy went out there one day and he had just gotten tired of it. He went out with a shotgun and he fired the shotgun in the air and he told him, he said, Billy, if you don't turn that lawnmower off, he said, the next shot is going to be you. And then, no, he said, that lawnmower, and then I'm going to shoot you. So Billy never cut his grass again at night.
But everybody said after that, Billy's really not crazy.
Yeah, and my daddy said, I told y'all he wasn't crazy. He had a good understanding. But he didn't take no stuff off of anyone. No one. You know, I can only imagine some of the things that he probably actually went through while in South Carolina, you know, when it first started out, the early days of him being in the Marines, because the Charles Allen that we knew later on, he did not take anything from anyone. It didn't matter what your color was, what your status was, what your rank was. He told you what was on his mind and he stuck by it. You could not budge him. And he would even tell the police, you know, look, you're wrong. I haven't done anything. Now if you want to take me in, you know, we had the police come to our house one time looking for my brother. And my dad said, you got a warrant? He said, no. He said, okay, get off my property right now. Yep. And he said, he got his shotgun. He said, off my property. Of course, that wouldn't go down in today's
world. No. That begs the question sometimes is whether things are better or worse, doesn't it?
Yeah, he didn't take any stuff off of anyone.
You know, he valued his Marine Corps time a lot. He didn't talk a lot about it, but he was very proud of what he had done. As a matter of fact, he named at least one dog, maybe more than one, Chesty.
Yeah.
Chesty Puller is a Marine Corps icon. And
from way back.
Yeah, from we're talking way back. And he named his dog after Chesty Puller.
Yeah.
So he thought a lot of his Marine Corps service, very proud of it, and very proud that we went in, but he never once said to any one of his sons, I wish you'd go in, I want you to go in, why don't you go in the Marine Corps? He never said that. But when we did, it was obvious that he was pretty proud that all four of his sons had done it.
Yep. And how did your mother feel about all of you all going in?
How did what?
Your mother feel?
Not the greatest. She didn't gripe, but she probably, especially for me and my older brother, because that was Vietnam time.
Right. And
she kind of felt like, wow, this is not a good time for this. She particularly had told me that she said, Mike, I wish you wouldn't do this. And the reason is because I grew up asthmatic as a child. And she kept saying, how are you going to make it? How are you going to make it in boot camp? How are you going to do this? You have asthma. You got asthma attacks. And I said, I'll be all right. And I went to boot camp. And that first letter she wrote me, she asked me, how's your asthma? I wrote her back and I told her, there's no time here for asthma. You don't have a chance. But yeah, he prepared us pretty well for that, just in a lot of ways.
So there were six of you, the four sons and two daughters. I'm interested in hearing more about everybody's background. I know, Mike, you were a career Marine.
I spent 26 years in Marine Corps. The majority of my 26 years were the reserve. I did active duty. I went in during Vietnam time. I served in Vietnam. I stayed long enough that I served in Desert Storm. And I retired in 1995.
And what kind of work have you been doing since then?
When I first left the Marine Corps, while I was still in, I was working in the aerospace division of Ford Motor Company in Newport Beach, California. I worked there for about 8 years. And then in mid-80s, my wife and I decided we wanted to come back to New Orleans because I realized that my kids did not know my parents.
Right.
They were like, who is that? Is that your mom or mom's mom? And I was like, oh, no, 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 no. I want them to know my parents. I want my parents to know them. So we moved back to New Orleans and I worked several jobs. I owned a little janitorial service for a little while. I worked for the Louisiana Lottery as a regional manager for 10 years. I can't remember now, for a while. Actually, more 15 years. And right now I work for a state agency, and we offer services and treatment to people who may be suffering with mental illness, addictions, and intellectual developmental issues. So that's what I do now, but I do it on the contract. I'm a contract person. So, if I want to work, I work. If I don't want to work, I don't.
Yep. That's the position to be in. So,
but also if I work, I get paid. If I don't work, I don't get paid.
All right. That's the other side of it.
Yeah.
That's the other side. So Marlon, you continued your father's footsteps post your military career. So you were in the U.S. Postal Service?
Yes, for 38 years. I worked at the post office for 38 years, plus my 5 years in the Marines. So when I retired with a total of 43 years, and I don't regret a minute of it. I enjoyed myself. I went in the Postal Service in 1981. I started out as a clerk and eventually moved around a little bit, worked in marketing, worked in customer service operations. I taught the window clerk class. I did quite a few things, and then eventually I got into to the real heavy management side and became a station manager of almost every station in New Orleans at one time or another. They would kind of move me around and send me to stations that had problems or situations.
Doc, I'm interrupting here. He got moved around from station to station because these were problem stations. And the other managers were too weak to get things straight or didn't know how. When Marlon walked into the stations, he pulled the Charles Allen on him and told him, look, I'm not here to play. I'm not here to play. We got a job to do and I need you to do it. And if you can't do it, then we need to get rid of you. And
that's not exactly how it went.
They soon realized that when Marlon comes to the station, you got to get your act cleaned up or there's going to be problems.
That's I never said those type of words to anyone. How can I put it, in a group? If I spoke in the workroom area to everyone, it was always something positive. Now, when I told you I need to see you in my office, then that's a different story. You know, but
he was moved around to cleanup stations.
Right.
Stations that weren't productive, that weren't running right. They moved him around to clean this one up. And when that one got to running straight, they moved to another one to straighten that one up.
That's the doc. I was a good manager. I was a good manager, and I dealt with people the way I wanted to be dealt with. And, you know, I had an understanding with those that worked for me. As a matter of fact, I told you earlier that we had a funeral that I went to yesterday. That was a guy who worked for me at one of the stations. And he was a real good guy. So when I heard that he had gotten killed, there was no way I was not going to go. Right. And it was really good, you know, to see a lot of people that I used to work with or used to, you know, and there's still a lot of people that work at the post office that I still help to, you know, get promotions and do things for them, because there's a lot of good people out there that don't get recognized for what they do for one reason or another. And I a lot of people would help me, tell me, you know, can you help me make supervisor? Can you? And sometimes I would, and because I felt they were worthy. And there's sometimes when it was a person, I said, that's not the person that I think ought to be moving up. So, you know, I kind of push it aside. I forgot. I'm sorry. No, you can't do that. No, I can't put my name on the line for you.
Really?
It was always one reason or another, but you know.
But Doc, the bottom line is, though, the methods, and I'm not cutting them all, and I don't know if that's what he's thinking, but the methods that he used, the methods that I use in management, all come from
Charles Allen.
Charles Allen, and the way he dealt with people. He stern, but fair. You know, and to me, that there's nothing wrong with that. Stern, but fair.
Yeah.
Well, and there's one. You and we're going to tell you about the other kids too, but there's one major difference between Mike and I. When Mike talks, Mike is clean, you know, language, choice of words. Mine are clean when it's in front of everyone, but when I call you in the office, I mean business.
Okay.
That's the way, and then I'm going to tell you whether if I have to come down to your standards to lay it across to you, then I will. If I have to raise up a little bit, then I will. But I'm going to treat you like you need to be treated at the time. But I was a good manager. I was.
I was going to ask you, tell me about your four siblings.
Yeah, the other kids, let's see. My oldest sister, who is actually the oldest of the kids, she's deceased now. She died not long after Hurricane Katrina. She went through a lot with Hurricane Katrina. She lost a lot, lost her house, lost two pieces of rental property, lost, at the time, her job was put in jeopardy because they were thinking of not opening Southern University in New Orleans again. And she was the Dean of Graduate Studies there. And she kind of led the fight to keep it open. And less than a year after Katrina, you know, the stress and all, and plus we found out that she had been sick and we didn't know it. She never told anyone. And she passed away. But she was pretty amazing. At her funeral, they had a lot of people wanted to speak, even people from Africa, where she had gone to help to set up a university over in Africa. But she was a pretty amazing person. She really was.
Very, very accomplished. And, you know, sometimes the people in your household, you look at them, you say, that's just my sister, that's just my dad, that's just my mom. But then when you start reading off her accomplishments, and you think, wait a minute, wow,
Sometimes, it's when you go to the funerals that you hear a lot of things you didn't know before. You say, "Oh, that was just my sister," and it's like, "Wait a minute, she did this, and they said that about her." It's like, "Wow."
Yeah. Especially with a person like her that didn't talk a lot about what she was involved in and what she was doing.
She did a lot. She did a lot. I think Katrina was just too much for her. You know, she was suffering with cancer, as Marlon said. We didn't know that. But after Katrina, I think the stress on her was great because, you know, Katrina took place August of 2005 and she died April of 2006.
Yeah.
Man.
So it just was too much. Then there's a second sister right under her, the second sibling, the second child in the family. She, they both graduated from the same high school, Catholic High School, St. Mary's here in New Orleans. Gladys went on to become registrar at Southern University, right next to her sister. Gladys is talk. Gladys never stops talking. Everybody on the campus knows her, you know, and I think she, even when it was time to retire, she didn't really want to. She's done a lot too at Southern. She's very instrumental in working with trying to keep the school open and very accomplished also, you know. All of them are accomplished. I'm just me, but everybody else has degrees and whatnot. Mike doesn't. But she was, and then after Gladys came Chuck. That's my dad's namesake, Charles Allen Jr. And he went to boot camp with me. He and I went to boot camp at the same time. Matter of fact, when we enlisted on what they called then the buddy plan. And the buddy plan meant that we were going to go to boot camp together, be in the same platoon in boot camp. And Chuck got in boot camp, and I think only a few weeks into it, he sprained his ankle, which he probably had done before. Because when he sprained his ankle the next morning, when everybody was getting up for the day, his ankle was as big as a God, it was almost big as a basketball. It was so swollen. And the drill instructors panicked. And they said, "Oh, God, get him out of here." At first, they were yelling, "Get him out of the rack. Get him up." And when they came to take a look at it, they said, "Oh, no, we got to get him out of here." So he ended up being retiring. Or he didn't retire, but he ended up being discharged. They determined that his ankle was not going to heal, that it would develop arthritis in the ankle. So he got out. And then the next child is Marlon. You already know about Marlon.
Well, no, it's no. Me. You got Lyle.
It's me.
For you.
Yeah. And then came Lyle. And Lyle was the jewel of the family. Lyle knew everything. If there was something happening in the street, Lyle knew. He knew who, what, when, where, and why. He was very streetwise. He was a piece of work, but he had a heart of gold. Lyle would, he'd do anything for you. And when I spoke at Lyle's funeral, I said, you know, if you really know him, you know he would give you the shirt off his back. But if he thought you had too many shirts, he might take one of yours. You know, but he was a good person. He got shot in 1979, right?
Yep, 79.
He got shot by an off-duty police officer. Without going through the whole story, it was supposedly mistaken identity. And the officer shot him several times, not just once. As a matter of fact, when the last time he shot him, Lyle was laying on the floor in the convenience store, and this police officer stand over him and shot him again. Young rookie cop, some described him as the John Wayne attitude. Did not get prosecuted for attempted murder. The district attorney went for attempted murder, but they couldn't get a conviction. It was an all-white jury.
Right.
So they convicted him of attempted manslaughter.
Okay.
And for that, he ended up doing 18 months in jail. And even though our family and a lot of other people protested him being paroled, he was paroled after 18 months.
But he went on to get the same guy that shot our brother, went on to do several other things. I think he shot somebody else.
Right.
I think he shot a neighbor or something.
His mother's neighbor. After he got out, he shot his mother's neighbor over an argument about the property line, who was cutting whose grass.
So I don't know what
happened. Oh, I have mercy.
Ultimately, I don't know what happened to that guy, but yeah, he was troubled. I mean, he got in other trouble after that. So then Lyle, and then last but not least is Marlon.
Right.
And you know a little bit about both of us already.
How old was your dad when he passed?
He passed in 2000.
Yeah.
And that would put him at
77?
Yeah. He hadn't quite made it yet.
Yeah, he would have made 77 in that July.
Yeah, he hadn't quite made it. He died.
His last few years, he suffered pretty badly with Alzheimer's.
Okay.
You know, he went through a period of, you know, just kind of forgetting things and, you know, things being a little bit awkward. And then I'd say probably about maybe last 4 years, 3 to 4 years, he was, the Alzheimer's had really taken over. And, you know, it was kind of like a different person. We you know, he didn't talk much. He didn't, you know, every now and then he would talk about something, but it'd be about something from way in the past, you know. But Alzheimer's, I learned quite a bit about it with him. And it is one horrible disease. It's horrible. It's almost like a different person was there.
Right.
The only thing that you recognize is the person you see, but other than that, this person you know is not there. Not there.
And then sometimes they don't recognize you either. So
no. Right.
No. Yeah.
And even when they do recognize you, and the doctors had told us in a family meeting that he may recognize you, but he will not say your name or anything, because Alzheimer's sufferers, that's part of their defense mechanism. Instead of saying who you are or exactly what something is, they'll, you know, just say him or you. Or like we would ask my dad, said, did you eat? He said, yeah. I said, well, what did you eat? He said, what she fixed, meaning my mother.
Right.
So
You know, he had to, but you know what, even before his Alzheimer's really kicked in, let's put it this way, before we knew what he was going through, he always had a little defense mechanism where he would, if you ask him a question, he would say, he'd ask you a question. You'd say, well, did so-and-so come? Who was that came? And he'd go, you don't know? And we'd say, no. He'd say, well, if you don't know, I don't know. But he'd always ask a question back because he didn't, you know, couldn't quite remember some things, and that was his little defense,
right?
By throwing the question back at you.
Yeah, a little off-putting for the person who asked the questions.
Yeah.
Is he interred in a veteran cemetery or a family cemetery?
Family. Okay. Yeah, family cemetery. Matter of fact, I don't even know if he ever got a military plot.
No.
We don't know if he ever even had papers on it or anything, because I know a lot of people, they may get awarded one and the family chooses not to use it because they put the, you know, the person in, like we did, in a family plot near family. I don't know. And he, like we said, he was the type that did not discuss a whole lot, but you get bits and pieces here and there. And that was something that I don't think he ever spoke of.
Yeah, both of my parents are buried in they're both buried in Arlington rather than their family cemeteries. But they're next to each other, and
Yeah, that's good. That was never an option that we considered, to be honest with you.
Now, Doc, I guess to kind of put it in a nutshell about our dad. I say he was a hellraiser. That's the, if we got to put it in one word. But very, very intelligent. You know, he didn't just go off at a whim, fire at someone for no reason. He would always calculate, but he was the type that I kind of learned a little lesson from, where people say you pick your battles.
Right.
Okay, where his method was, I fight every battle, but sometimes when I don't fight right then, that's my choice of how I'm doing that battle at that time. But he never would let you get away with something. You can, if it took 10 years, he'd come back 10 years later and tell you, you know, back in 19, whatever, you, you know, he didn't let you forget. I know. And that was one of the reasons why when he started suffering with Alzheimer's, it was a big thing, because he didn't forget anything. He didn't.
Yeah.
You know, Doc, over the years, I've learned that there's certain MOSs in the military that are prone to certain things. And I learned that drill instructor, that MOS is prone to alcoholism. There's a high rate of it in that MOS.
No, the MOS stands for?
Military Occupational Specialty, or your job.
Okay, thank you.
Your job. And I learned that drill instructors is an MOS that has a high rate of alcoholism. And I think it's probably because of what they do every day. I mean, it's a pretty stressful job that they do every day, every single day. And he did it his whole time. And he developed alcoholism. And with Charles Allen, when he wasn't drinking, he was the best man in the world. When he get into his alcohol, he could be a little difficult. But for the most part, he was a good person all the time. And I tell a story, and I told this story at his funeral. People knew him as a tough guy to deal with at times, but only when he felt it was necessary. But I talked about that, you know, as rough as he might have been, I recall one time when it was Christmas, close to Christmas, and we were only within a few days of Christmas, and we didn't have a Christmas tree, and the car wasn't running. And Charles Allen got on the bus and went to go get a Christmas tree and brought it back on the bus. And I remember him saying that the bus driver told him, "You can't bring that on a tree on a bus, a tree on a bus." And he said, "You know, Chuck, well, probably I can't repeat the words he told the bus driver, but he let him know, we're going to bring it on here today. And what you need to do is take me home." But he brought a Christmas tree home on the, because he said, we got to have it. And I just thought that that shows the kind of person he was. You know, he said, my kids need a Christmas tree and we're going to get one no matter what.
Yeah.
You know what though, Doc? Let me tell you the type of person that he was. We always had a station wagon because he had six kids. So, you know, like in today's SUVs, but back then it was a station wagon.
Right,
a big,
right.
Long station wagon with three seats. He took all of the boys in the neighborhood and brought them out to the Lake Punch train and taught everybody how to swim. When he would pile everybody in the station wagon, he would take us all out to a Bayou Avenue and teach us how to fish and crab. And this is all the boys in the neighborhood. You know, with me being the youngest, they're all pretty much older than me, but I'm the tag along. But he did things like that. He would take us all over to by what we would call the stadium. It's a stadium near Southern University. Then he played baseball with us, teach us how to play baseball. He was really active, and a lot of kids in the neighborhood would say, "Your dad is cool, he's a great guy," but they didn't know what it was like living, you know. So that's the type of person that he was. So he and people in the neighborhood would, you know, say, oh, Charles did this, Charles did that. You know, everybody knew Charles. We had an old-fashioned ice cream machine where you turn it with your hand. Right. Okay, well, we would have to take turns turning that. He would mix up the concoction and pour it in there and put the ice and the rock salt and all that, and then he'd take it to his four sons and say, all right, everybody take a turn turning this thing. And then he'd go around the neighborhood and give it out, and everybody say, oh, Charles made this ice cream. But nobody knew he used the label was his kid.
You know? Look, remember that guy we talked about, Billy?
Yes.
Next to a neighbor. Well, Billy had this daughter who was sick, who probably weighed 300, maybe 400 pounds. And I'm not exaggerating.
No, she was huge.
She was bedridden. She could not walk. She could not move. All of the neighbors did not like Billy. Not some of the neighbors. All of them disliked Billy because of his demeanor, because of the things that he used to do. But when the hurricane hit and everybody was trying to get out, evacuate, Charles Allen said, we're not leaving this girl here. And the neighbors, all the neighborhood men were like, man, why should we help Billy? And Charles Allen said, we are not going to leave her here. We're going to get her out of here, and I need all y'all to help me get her out of that house, into our station wagon to evacuate her. And they did, because Charles Allen said, we're all going to do it. It wasn't a choice. And we evacuated her out with his own kids walking in the water behind the car with her in the car, in the station wagon, and evacuated her out. And Marlon can tell you that when they got all the way to Suno, because that's where we evacuated to, what'd they say? Billy say what?
Billy wanted to thank, he said, Charles, I really want to thank you for what you did for my daughter. And my dad looked at him and he said, Billy, I did that for that girl. He said, if that had been you, B-U-T over there, he said, you'd have got left behind. So,
but that's the kind of person he was. And he told him, all the neighbors felt like, why should we help him? He's been a pain in everybody's butt. And Charles said, no, we got to get out.
Now, this was in 1964. This was Hurricane Betsy. This wasn't Katrina.
Okay, I was wondering. I was trying to make all these numbers work. But okay.
Oh no.
Yeah, this was in 19. Yeah, this was when we were still little kids, you know, and we were still learning things. And he said, you know, from learning from him, and he said, hey, he said, we're not leaving until we get this girl out of here. Yeah. And of course, Billy was too afraid to even ask anybody for help because he knew nobody. He knew that no one really liked
him. He hadn't made many friends in the neighborhood. Eh?
No, not at all.
Nope.
So it was a significant honor when your dad received the Congressional Gold Medal. What was the reaction in your family when you found out?
When we found out that he was going to get it, I think it was pride. I wouldn't say shock, but pride. We were all very proud of that. We found out that he was, well, 2011 when it got approved, 2012 they handed out the first ones. We didn't go to Washington to get his. We got his locally. But I think it was a great deal of pride. I think, you know, it's one of those things that you kind of realize it, but as time goes on, you begin to really realize the significance of it. And I think more and more we begin to realize how big of a deal this was, particularly when you look at the list of people who have received the Congressional Gold Medal. Martin Luther King, Coretta Scott King, Mamie and Emmett Till, Jackie Robinson.
Right.
The list goes on and on. And I looked it up, and there's only been, the first ones were handed out in the 18th century.
Yeah, George Washington was the first one, and I think there've only been a couple hundred total.
173. I looked it up. Now, how accurate is what I found on the internet? You know, there could be 175 today, but 173 when I looked it up. That's how many Congressional Gold Medals have been handed out.
So when you think about that, that's pretty big.
That is.
And I had to actually just try to make some people who I'm trying to help get their father's congressional gold medal. And they were acting like, yeah, well, okay, maybe we'll show up, maybe we won't. I said, let me give you an understanding of what this is. Let me give you an understanding of who has received it and where your father's name is going to be forever mentioned. You know? And when you look at that, you begin to realize how significant this is, how big this is. So, yeah, it's a source of pride. And I think we felt it when it first came up. But I think as time goes by, you really begin to understand even more how big of an issue it is, how prestigious this is.
So share any reflections on what your father's life and legacy mean to you and your family when you kind of think about him. And the totality of his experiences in your life with him, what does his legacy mean to you?
Well, for me, I'd have to say it's one of more of what Mike just said is extreme pride, because the biggest part of all of that to me, I don't want to say the biggest part, but what's a great deal of it is when I got the opportunity, when I had the opportunity to read some of that congressional act that President Obama signed, because I mean, the Marfa Point Marines didn't get recognized until President Obama,
right,
for Black president, in 2011, he signed that act, awarding them congressional gold medals, and in that congressional act, there's only certain names that are mentioned in it. And one of the names was the first African-American that enlisted in the Marines, which I don't know his name offhand. The first Black officer.
Branch is his name, I know that.
Yeah, Lieutenant Branch, he was a lieutenant at that time. And then the other names were those six Black drill instructors, the first six Black drill instructors. And to see my dad's name in that piece of paper, in that the verbiage of that act, I'm gonna be honest with you, it just reading it and seeing his name, it kind of brought tears to me. And I'm not one that I just cry over any little thing, but yeah, it brought tears to my eyes, because we know that he was very proud of having been one of the first, you know. And he used to always make this little statement sometimes that it was six of them that got their papers to be a drill instructor at the same time. And in the military, everything goes by rank and then by alphabetical order. And with his last name being Allen, starting with an A, he would always say, I got my papers first. So, he would say, I was the first. I was, yeah. And
I say it too. I say he was the first.
Yeah. So, you know, you know, when reading that congressional act or that piece of paper, and knowing that it was signed by the first Black president ever, first African-American president, it just made it seem like more. It made it mean more. You know, it gave a deeper feeling.
Yeah.
You know, when you ask the question about how you feel about his legacy, I say this. The Congressional Gold Medal is obviously huge, but I think that I'm a decent person. I think that I'm a good father and a good husband. And all of those things, being a good person, being a good father, being a good husband, I think I attribute that to the way he raised us. I attribute all of that to him, because he made it very clear of what's important in life. You know, take care of your family, look out for them, provide for them, protect them. And I find that there's a lot of men my age and young men who don't have those values. And I didn't just develop that because I was just a smart person. No, I developed that because of him, because of the way he handled his business. Regardless as to what his battles he had with alcohol, he never failed to provide for his family. He never failed to protect his family. And I feel that I got that from him. So that's the biggest thing. The Congressional Gold Medal is great. It's wonderful. You know, like we just said, there's very few people who will ever be able to say they received one. And I'm certainly proud that he did receive one. I'm proud of what he did. But I'm also mostly proud that he made me who I am.
Yes, that's a pretty powerful statement. So I have just one final question for you, gentlemen tonight. So what lessons from your dad's life story can you share to inspire young African-Americans to embrace fear as opportunity so they can be their best selves? You know, your father shattered glass ceilings when he went into the Marines. And so often young people say, I can't do that because someone else, because no one like me has ever done it before, or people like me don't do things like that. So what lessons from your dad's life story can you share to say, to get people to get out of that rut and go and be their best selves?
You know, I don't think he ever used the word can't. I can't do it. I don't want to do it, but he never used the word can't, because if you want to, you can. You just got to want to. If you don't want to, you can't. But if you want to, you can. Everybody that's done it before you, everybody that's trying to do it right along with you, they're no better than you. You're as good as any of them. And if they can do it, you can do it. And I think that's one of the things that he always, I don't think I've ever heard him say, I don't think I can do that. No, he's never felt that he couldn't do something. He may say, I don't want to do that, but if I want to, I can. And I don't find that to be something that the young generation today, there's a lot of things about the young generation that are bothersome to me. They don't have a good work ethic. They want everything easy. They want everything quick. And I've even labeled them as the microwave generation, because they want everything quick. They want it to happen now, right away. They don't want to spend time working on it. They don't want to put in to pay their dues. They want it all to happen quickly. And life just doesn't operate that way.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of feel the same way, especially knowing what my daddy's background is, where he came from. You know, he's the son of slaves. His family was slaves in Gloucester, Mississippi. You mentioned Gloucester before when we first got on, but Gloucester is a small town in Mississippi where, when back in the early 1900s, late 1800s, if you were living on property, you were a slave to someone. You know, his family eventually became landowners, which was land that was left to him by the slave masters. You know, being that he came from that background and, you know, was at Tuskegee Institute playing football in the ROTC, and then went on to become one of the first African-Americans to ever join the Marines and one of the first Black drill instructors. It just, like I said, it means more that, to me, knowing that background. And like Michael was just saying, he would always say, if you want to do it, you can do it. And that was one of the things that he used to say about anything. If you want to do it, you can do it. You know, when you're a kid growing up, you don't realize a lot of the things that what they actually mean and the value of them. But as we got older, or as I got older and started to look back, and I said, you know, he was a heck of a guy, you know, to go through some of the things that he went through, and especially given his background, it's not like he he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, or he was, you know, George Bush, the junior who, you know what I'm saying, didn't have to do real time in the military, didn't have to work at anything. No, he actually had to work and earn his way. And
you know, Doc, one of the, I think one of the most poignant tributes that somebody gave my dad was a few days after he died. One of the neighbors around in the, just up the street from us, Mr. Washington. I saw Mr. Washington and he looked at me and he said, "Your dad, he was a hell of a man." He said, "He was a man right up to the other day when he died." He said, he's one of the people in this neighborhood that was always a man. And when he said those words, you know, he doesn't mean gender. He meant he was a full man. He did everything that a man should do. And listening to him say that, it meant a lot. And I think he voiced that opinion, which was pretty much widespread in the neighborhood. You know, everybody in the neighborhood respected Charles Allen. Everybody in the neighborhood looked to Charles Allen. And I say respect, not fear, right. Although they may have feared him, but they've also respected him because they knew that they could count on him. They could count on him to do whatever needs to be done.
Oh yeah, they can count on him because he would send his children out to do things in the neighborhood all the time. You know, if somebody had a flat tire, he'd tell his four sons, go fix that flat tire. Somebody had a load of dirt, we'd have to go shovel that dirt. You know, so
you learned about community service very early on, eh?
Oh, yes. Yes, and a lot of times we would say, but Daddy, you know, we was getting ready, he'd say, yeah, after you go over there and do that, after we go do that, you know. So yeah, a lot of people did love him because they had automatic labor from his four sons.
Oh yeah. But he was a good man. I tell you though, he was a good man. I think everybody admired him, you know, everybody respected him and everybody wished they could be like him.
Well, Mike and Marlon, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing your family story. I'm very grateful.
But thank you for having us. Appreciate that. It's a pleasure to do this with you.
Well, we'll have every opportunity to get as many of these stories out to other generations as possible.
And that's a good idea. I tell you, I fought this battle with Montford people knowing about Montford Point. You know, we've always known about Montford Point. We didn't just learn about it 10 years ago, 3 years ago, like a lot of people did. We've always known about Montford Point. And when I went in the Marine Corps in 1969, I found that a lot of people either didn't know or wanted me to believe they didn't know. And I was thinking to myself, how could something this significant, no one knows about it?
Right.
And we'd constantly talk about it through my time in the Marine Corps, and it never really took off. But then in the last 15, 20 years, I guess, it started to take off finally. But I'm glad it did. I think it's something that, you know, when I have a chance to talk to groups about this, I always tell, particularly at funerals of Montford Pointers or Congressional Gold Medal presentations, and I tell the audience that this is a story that I hope your great, great, great grandchildren will one day pick up a book. It may not be a book as we know it, but it may be something electronic, and able to look and say, that's my great, great, great grandfather. This is what he did. You know, they need to be able to do that. They need to have that history. They need to have that pride that we feel right now.
Right.
You know, and yeah, I want them. And you know, we as you know, we got people right now around the country trying to decide what part of history should be told, what part of history should be kept. I don't know where we get off making that decision, but this is something that everybody needs to know about. You know, what they did was huge. It was huge. And it's part of our history, and everybody needs to learn about it. Everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Nexus 818 Podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I'd like to end this show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I will share a quote from Beyonce Knowles. Your self-worth is determined by you. You do not have to depend on someone telling you who you are. See you for our next show on Wednesday, December 6th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, New York City Podcast Network, and Spotify for Podcasters.